seeds, left too near the edge of the shelf, fell off and smashed on the floor, scattering tiny black seeds like pepper grains. Now look what you've done.
What I've...
Never mind. Just never mind. Get out of here. She was puffing like a grampus with the effort not to cry. Her cheeks were hot with blood, and her eyeballs felt red, bloodshot, so hot that she felt she might sear him with a look. Certainly she wished she could. He hovered, clearly trying to decide whether to stay and conciliate his disgruntled wife, or rush off in chivalrous protection of Mulva Christie. He took a hesitant step toward the door, and she dived for the broom, making stupid, high-pitched squeaks of incoherent rage as she swung it at his head. He ducked, but she got him on the second swing, catching him across the ribs with a thwack. He jerked in surprise at the impact, but recovered fast enough to catch the broom on the next swing. He yanked it out of her hand, and with a grunt of effort, broke it over his knee with a splintering crack. He threw the pieces clattering at her feet and glared at her, angry but self-possessed.
"What in the name of God is the matter with you?"
She drew up tall and glared back. "What I said. If you're spending so much time with Amy McCullum that it's common talk you're having an affair with her."
"And what?"
His voice broke with outrage, but there was a shifty look in his eyes that gave him away. "So, you've heard it too, haven't you?" She didn't feel triumphant at having caught him out, more a sense of sick fury.
"You can't possibly think that's true, Bree," he said,
his voice pitched uncertainly between angry repudiation and pleading.
"I know it isn't true," she said,
and was furious to hear her own voice as shaky and cracked as his was.
"That's not the effing point, Roger."
"The point?" he repeated.
His black brows were drawn down, his eyes sharp and dark beneath them.
"The point," she said, gulping air, "is that you're always gone. Mulva Christie, Amy McCullum, Masali, Lizzie. You even go help Uta McGillivray, for God's sake."
"Who else is to do it?" he asked sharply. "Your father or your cousin, might I. But they've to be gone to the Indians. I'm here." "And I'm not always gone," he added as an afterthought. "I'm home every night, am I not?"
She closed her eyes and clenched her fists, feeling the nails dig into her palms.
"You'll help any woman but me," she said, opening her eyes. "Why is that?"
He gave her a long, hard look, and she wondered for an instant whether there was such a thing as a black emerald.
"Maybe I didn't think you needed me," he said.
And turning on his heel, he left. Chapter 51. The Calling. The water lay calm as melted silver, the only movement on it the shadows of the evening clouds. But the hatch was about to rise. You could feel it.
Or perhaps, Roger thought,
what he felt was the expectation in his father-in-law, crouched like a leopard on the bank of the trout pool, pole and fly at the ready for the first sign of a ripple.
"Like the pool at Bethesda,"
he said, amused.
"Oh, aye," Jamie answered,
but didn't look at him, his attention fixed on the water.
"The one where an angel would go down into the pool and trouble the water now and then, so everyone sat about waiting so as to plunge in the minute the water began to stir."
Jamie smiled, but still didn't turn. Fishing was serious business. That was good. He'd rather not have Jamie look at him. But he'd have to hurry if he meant to say something. Fraser was already paying out the line to make a practice cast or two.
"I think..."
He stopped himself, correcting.
"No, I don't think. I know. I want..."
His air ran out in a wheeze, annoying him. The last thing he wanted was to sound in any way doubtful about what he was saying. He took a huge breath
and the next words shot out as though fired from a pistol.
I mean to be a minister.
Well then, he'd said it out loud. He glanced upward, involuntarily. But sure enough, the sky hadn't fallen. It was hazed and riffled with mare's tails, but the blue calm of it showed through, and the ghost of an early moon floated just above the mountain's shoulder. Jamie glanced thoughtfully at him, but didn't seem shocked or taken aback. That was some small comfort, he supposed.
A minister? A preacher, do you mean? Well, aye, that too.
The admission disconcerted him. He supposed he would have to preach, though the mere notion of it was terrifying.
What? Too?
Fraser repeated, looking at him sideways.
Aye. I mean, a minister does preach, of course.
Of course.
What about? How? But that's not... I mean, that's not the main thing. Not why I have to do it.
He was getting flustered, trying to explain clearly something that he couldn't even explain properly to himself. He sighed and rubbed a hand over his face.
Aye, look. You recall Granny Wilson's funeral, of course. And the McCollums.
Jamie merely nodded, but Roger thought perhaps a flicker of understanding showed in his eyes.
I've done a few things. A bit like that, when it was needed. And...
He twitched a hand, unsure even how to begin describing things like his meeting with Herman Husband on the banks of the Alamance, or the conversations had with his dead father late at night. He sighed again, made to toss a pebble into the water, and stopped himself just in time when he saw Jamie's hand tense round his fishing pole. He coughed, feeling the familiar choke and rasp in his throat, and closed his hand around the pebble.
The preaching, I suppose I'll manage. But it's the other things. Oh, God, this sounds insane. And I do believe I may be. It's the burying and the christening and the maybe just being able to help, even if it's only by listening and praying.
You want to take care of them,
Jamie said softly. And it wasn't a question, but rather an acceptance. Roger laughed a little, unhappily, and closed his eyes against the sparkle of the sun off the water.
I don't want to do it, he said. It's the last thing I thought of, and me growing up in a minister's house. I mean, I ken what it's like. But someone has to do it. And I'm thinking it's me.
Neither of them spoke for a bit. Roger opened his eyes and watched the water. Algae coated the rocks, wavering in the current like locks of mermaid's hair. Fraser stirred a little, drawing back his rod.
Do Presbyterians believe in the sacraments, would you say?
Yes, Roger said, surprised. Of course we do. Have you never...
Well, no, he supposed, in fact, Fraser never had spoken to anyone not a Catholic regarding such matters.
We do, he repeated.
He dipped a hand gently in the water and wiped it across his brow so the coolness ran down his face and down his neck inside his shirt.
It's holy orders, I mean, Ken.
The drowned fly swam through the water, a tiny speck of red.
Will you not need to be ordained?
Oh, I see. Aye. I would. There's a Presbyterian academy in Mecklenburg County. I'll go there and speak with them about it. Though I'm thinking it will not take such a time. I've had the Greek and Latin already. And for what it's worth.
He smiled, despite himself.
I've a degree from Oxford University. Believe it or not, I was once thought an educated man.
Jamie's mouth twitched at the corner as he drew back his arm and snapped his wrist. The line sailed out, a lazy curve, and the fly settled. Roger blinked. Sure enough, the surface of the pool was beginning to pucker and shiver. Tiny ripples spreading out from the rising hatch of mayflies and damselflies.
Have you spoken to your wife about it?
No, he said, staring across the pool.
Why not?
There was no tone of accusation in the question, more curiosity.
Why, after all, should he have chosen to talk to his father-in-law first, rather than his wife?
Because you know what it is to be a man, he thought, and she doesn't.
What he said, though, was another version of the truth.
I don't want her to think me a coward.
Jamie made a small noise, almost surprise, but didn't reply at once, concentrating on reeling in his line. He took the sodden fly from the hook, then hesitated over the collection on his hat, finally choosing a delicate green thing with a curving wisp of black feather.
Do you think she would?
Not waiting for an answer, Fraser stood and whipped the line up and back, sending the fly out to drift down over the centre of the pool, lighting like a leaf on the water. Roger watched as he brought it in, playing it over the water in a jerky dance.
The Reverend had been a fisherman.
All at once, he saw the Ness and its sparkling riffles running clear brown over the rocks. Dad, standing in his battered waders, reeling in his line. He was choked with longing for Scotland, for his father, for one more day, just one, of peace.
The mountains and the green wood rose up, mysterious and wild around them, and the hazy sky unfurled itself over the hollow like angels' wings, silent and sunlit, but not peaceful. Never peace. Not here.
Do you believe us, Claire, Brianna and me, about the war that's coming?
Jamie laughed shortly, a gaze fixed on the water.
A wise man. It doesn't take either prophet or witch to see it standing on the road.
That, said Roger, giving him a curious look, is a very odd way of putting it.
Is it?
So?
Is that no what the Bible says? When ye shall see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not, then let them in Judea flee to the mountains.
Let him who readeth understand.
Memory supplied the missing part of the verse, and Roger became aware, with a small sense of cold in the bone, that Jamie did indeed see it standing on the road, and recognized it. Nor was he using figures of speech. He was describing precisely what he saw, because he had seen it before. The sound of small boys yelling in joy drifted across the water, and Fraser turned his head a little, listening. A faint smile touched his mouth. Then he looked down into the moving water, seeming to grow still. The ropes of his hair stirred against the sunburned skin of his neck, in the same way that the leaves of the mountain ash moved above. Roger wanted suddenly to ask Jamie whether he was afraid, but kept silence. He knew the answer in any case.
It doesn't matter.
He breathed deep and felt the same answer to the same question asked of himself. It didn't seem to come from anywhere, but was just there, inside him, as though he had been born with it. Always known it.
It doesn't matter. You will do it anyway.
They stayed for some time in silence. Jamie cast twice more with the green fly, then shook his head and muttered something, reeled it in, changed it for a dun fly, and cast again. The little boys charged past on the other bank, naked as eels, giggling, and disappeared through the bushes.
Really odd, Roger thought.
He felt all right. Still not having the slightest idea what he meant to do exactly, still seeing the drifting cloud coming toward them, and now knowing much more about what lay within it. But still all right. Jamie had a fish on the line. He brought it in fast and jerked it, shining and flapping, onto the bank, where he killed it with a sharp blow on a rock, before tucking it into his creel.
"Do you mean to turn Quaker?" Jamie asked seriously.
"No."
Roger was startled by the question. "Why'd you ask that?"
Jamie made the odd little half-shrugging gesture that he sometimes used when uncomfortable about something, and didn't speak again until he'd made the new cast.
"You said you didn't want Brianna to think you coward. I've fought by the side of a priest before."
One side of his mouth turned up, wry.
"Granted, he wasn't much of a swordsman, the Monsignor, and he couldn't hit the broadside of a barn with a pistol. But he was game enough."
"Oh." Roger scratched the side of his jaw.
"Aye, I take your meaning. No, I can't fight with an army, I don't think."
Saying it, he felt a sharp pain of regret.
"But take up arms in defence of those who need it. I can square that with my conscience, aye." "That's all right, then."
Jamie reeled in the rest of the line, shook water from the fly, and stuck the hook back into his hat. Laying the line aside, he rummaged in the creel and pulled out a stoneware bottle. He sat down with a sigh, pulled the cork with his teeth, spat it into his hand, and offered Roger the bottle.
"It's a thing Claire says to me now and again," he explained, and quoted, "Malt does more than Milton can to justify God's ways to man."
Roger lifted an eyebrow.
"Ever read Milton?" "A bit. She's right about it." "You ken the next lines?"
Roger lifted the bottle to his lips.
"Ale, man, ale's the stuff to drink for fellows whom it hurts to think."
A subterranean laugh moved through Fraser's eyes.
"This must be whiskey, then," he said. "It only smells like beer."
It was cool and dark and pleasantly bitter, and they passed the bottle to and fro, not saying much of anything, until the ale was gone. Jamie put the cork thriftily back in and tucked the empty bottle away in the creel.
"Your wife,"
he said thoughtfully, rising and hitching the strap of the creel onto his shoulder.
"Aye."
Roger picked up the battered hat bestrewn with flies and gave it to him. Jamie nodded thanks and set it on his head.
"She has eyes, too."
Chapter 52 M.I.C. Fireflies lit the grass, the trees, and floated through the heavy air in a profusion of cool green sparks. One lighted on Brianna's knee. She watched it pulse, on off, and listened to her husband telling her he meant to be a minister. They were sitting on the stoop of their cabin as the dusk thickened into night. Across the big clearing, the whoops of small children at play sounded in the bushes, high and cheerful as hunting bats.
"You could say something," Roger suggested.
His head was turned, looking at her. There was enough light yet to see his face, expectant, slightly anxious.
"Well, give me a minute. I sort of wasn't expecting this, you know."
That was true, and it wasn't. Certainly she hadn't consciously thought of such a thing, yet now that he'd stated his intentions, and he had, she thought, he wasn't asking her permission. She wasn't at all surprised. It was less a change than a recognition of something that had been there for some time. And in a way, it was a relief to see it and know it for what it was.
"Well," she said, after a long moment of consideration, "I think that's good."
"You do?"
The relief in his voice was palpable.
"Yes. If you're helping all these women because God told you to, that's better than doing it because you'd rather be with them than with me."
"Bree, you can't think that. That I..."
He leaned closer, looking anxiously into her face.
"You don't, do you?"
"Well, only sometimes," she admitted, "in my worst moments. Not most of the time."
He looked so anxious that she reached up and cupped her hand to the long curve of his cheek. The stubble of his beard was invisible in this light, but she could feel it soft and tickling against her palm.
"You're sure?" she said softly.
He nodded, and she saw his throat move as he swallowed.
I'm sure.
Are you afraid? He smiled a little at that.
Yeah.
I'll help, she said firmly. You tell me how, and I'll help. He took a deep breath, his face lightening, though his smile was rueful.
I don't know how, he said. How to do it, I mean. Let alone what you might do. That's what scares me.
Maybe not, she said. But you've been doing it anyway, haven't you? Do you need to do anything formal about this, though?
Or can you just announce you're a minister, like those TV preachers, and start taking up the collection right away?
He smiled at the joke, but answered seriously.
Bloody Romanist. You always think no one else has any claim to sacraments. We do, though. I'm thinking I'll go to the Presbyterian Academy, see what I need to do about ordination. As for taking up the collection, I expect this means I'll never be rich.
I sort of wasn't expecting that anyway, she assured him gravely.
Don't worry. I didn't marry you for your money. If we need more, I'll make it. How?
I don't know.
Not selling my body, probably. Not after what happened to Manfred. Don't even joke about that, he said.
His hand came down over hers, large and warm. Aidan McCullum's high, piercing voice floated through the air, and a sudden thought struck her.
Your flock.
The word struck her funny bone, and she giggled, despite the seriousness of the question. Will they mind that I'm a Catholic? She turned to him suddenly, another thought coming rapidly in its wake. You don't? You aren't asking me to convert?
No, I'm not, he said quickly, firmly. Not in a million years. As for what they might think or say.
His face twitched, caught between dismay and determination.
If they're not willing to accept it, well, they can just go to hell, that's all.
She burst out laughing, and he followed her, his laugh cracked, but without restraint.
The minister's cat is an irreverent cat, she teased.
How do you say that in Gaelic?
I've no idea. But the minister's cat is a relieved cat, he added, still smiling. I didn't know what you might think about it.
I'm not totally sure what I do think about it, she admitted. She squeezed his hand lightly. But I see that you're happy.
It shows.
He smiled, and the last of the evening light glowed briefly in his eyes, a deep and lambent green.
It shows. You're sort of lighted up inside.
Her throat felt tight. Roger, you won't forget about me and Jem, will you? I don't know that I can compete with God. He looked thunderstruck at that.
No,
he said, his hand tightening on hers, hard enough to make her ring cut into her flesh.
Not ever.
They sat silent for a little, the fireflies drifting down like slow green rain, their silent mating song lighting the darkening grass and trees. Roger's face was fading as the light failed, though she still saw the line of his jaw, set in determination.
I swear to you, Bree, he said, whatever I'm called to now, and God knows what that is, I was called to be your husband first. Your husband, and the father of your bairns above all things. And that I always shall be. Whatever I may do, it will not ever be at the price of my family. I promise you.
All I want, she said softly to the dark, is for you to love me. Not because of what I can do or what I look like, or because I love you. Just because I am.
Perfect, unconditional love, he said, just as softly. Some would tell you only God can love that way. But I can try.
Oh, I have faith in you, she said, and felt the glow of him reach her own heart.
I hope you always will, he said.
He raised her hand to his lips, kissed her knuckles in formal salutation, his breath warm on her skin. As though to test the resolution of his earlier declaration, Jem's voice rose and fell on the evening breeze, a small, urgent siren.
Daddy! Daddy! Daddy!
Roger sighed deeply, leaned over, and kissed her. A moment's soft, deep connection, then rose to deal with the emergency of the moment. She sat for a bit, listening. The sound of male voices came from the far end of the clearing, high and low, demand and question, reassurance and excitement. No emergency. Jem wanted to be lifted into a tree too high for him to climb alone. Then laughter and mad rustling of leaves. Oh, good grief, Roger was in the tree too. They were all up there, hooting like owls.
What are you laughing at, Anian?
Her father loomed out of the night, smelling of horses. Everything, she said, scooching over to make room for him to sit beside her. It was true. Everything seemed suddenly bright. The candlelight from the windows of the big house, the fireflies in the grass, the glow of Roger's face when he told her his desire. She could still feel the touch of his mouth on hers. It fizzed in her blood. Jamie reached up and fielded a passing firefly, holding it for a moment cupped in the dark hollow of his hand, where it flashed on and off, the cool light seeping through his fingers. Far off, she heard a brief snatch of her mother's voice coming through an open window. Claire was singing Clementine. Now the boys and Roger were howling at the moon, though it was no more than a pale sickle on the horizon. She felt her father's body shake with silent laughter, too.
"It reminds me of Disneyland," she said on impulse.
"Why? Where's that?"
"It's an amusement park for children," she added, knowing that while there were such things as amusement parks in places like London and Paris, these were purely adult places. No one ever thought of entertaining children now, beyond their own games and the occasional toy.
"Daddy and Mama took me there every summer," she said, slipping back without effort to the hot, bright days and warm California nights. "The trees all had little sparkling lights in them. The fireflies reminded me."
Jamie spread his palm. The firefly, suddenly free, pulsed to itself once or twice, then spread its wings with a tiny whirl and lifted into the air, floating up and away.
"Dwelt a miner, 49er, and his daughter Clementine."
"What was it like then?"
he asked curiously.
"Oh, it was wonderful."
She smiled to herself, seeing the brilliant lights of Main Street, the music and mirrors and beautiful beribboned horses of King Arthur's carousel. There were rides, we called them, a boat where you could float through the jungle on a river and see crocodiles and hippopotamuses and headhunters.
"Headhunters?" he said, intrigued.
"Not real ones," she assured him. "It's all make-believe. But it's, well, it's a world to itself. When you're there, the real world sort of disappears. Nothing bad can happen there. They call it the happiest place on earth. And for a little while, it really seems that way. Light she was, and like a fairy, and her shoes were number 9. Herring boxes without topsies, sandals were her for Clementine. And you'd hear music everywhere, all the time," she said, smiling. "Bands, groups of musicians playing instruments, horns and drums and things, would march up and down the streets and play in pavilions."
"Aye, that happens in amusement parks. Or it did, the once I was in one."
She could hear a smile in his voice as well.
"Mm-hmm. And there are cartoon characters. I told you about cartoons, walking round. You can go up and shake hands with Mickey Mouse or..."
"With what?"
"Mickey Mouse," she laughed. "A big mouse. Life-size. Human size, I mean. He wears gloves."
"A giant rat?"
he said, sounding slightly stunned.
"And they take the wings to play with it?"
"Not a rat, a mouse," she corrected him. and it's really a person dressed up like a mouse.
Why?
He said, not sounding terribly reassured. Yes. And an enormous carousel with painted horses, and a railroad train that goes through the Rainbow Caverns, where there are big jewels sticking out of the walls and coloured streams with red and blue water, and orange juice bars. Oh, orange juice bars.
She moaned softly in ecstatic remembrance of the cold, tart, overwhelming sweetness.
It was nice then, he said softly.
Thou art lost and gone forever, dreadful sorry, Clementine.
Yes, she said, sighed, and was silent for a moment. Then she leaned her head against his shoulder and wrapped her hand around his arm, big and solid.
You know what? She said, and he made a small interrogatory noise in reply. It was nice. It was great. But what I really, really loved about it was that when we were there, it was just the three of us, and everything was perfect. Mama wasn't worrying about her patients. Daddy wasn't working on a paper. They weren't ever silent or angry with each other. Both of them laughed. We all laughed all the time. While we were there.
He made no reply, but tilted his head so it rested against hers. She sighed again, deeply.
Jimmy won't get to go to Disneyland, but he'll have that. A family that laughs. And millions of little lights in the trees.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
A Breath of Snow and Ashes by Diana Gabaldon.
Part 7. Rolling Downhill. Chapter 53. Principles. From Fraser's Ridge, North Carolina, on the 3rd day of July, Anno Domini 1774, James Fraser, Esquire. To His Lordship John Gray at Mount Josiah Plantation in the colony of Virginia. My dear friend, I cannot begin to express our gratitude for your kind behaviour in sending a draft drawn upon your own bank as advance payment against the eventual sale of the objects I confided to your disposition. Mr. Higgins, in delivering this document, was, of course, most tactful, and yet I gathered from his anxious demeanour and his efforts at discretion that you may perhaps believe us to be in dire straits. I hasten to assure you that this is not the case. We will do well enough, so far as matters of victuals, clothes, and the necessities of life. I said that I would tell you the details of the affair, and I say that I must, if only to disabuse you of the vision of rampant starvation among my family and tenants. Beyond a small legal obligation requiring cash, I have a matter of business in hand involving the acquisition of a number of guns. I had been in hopes of acquiring these through the good offices of a friend, but find that this arrangement will no longer answer. I must look further abroad. I and my family are invited to a barbecue in honour of Miss Flora MacDonald, the heroine of the Rising. You are familiar with the lady, I believe. I recall your telling me once of your meeting with her in London, whilst she was imprisoned there, to take place next month at my aunt's plantation, River Run. As this affair will be attended by a great many Scots, some coming from considerable distances, I am in hopes that with cash in hand, I may make arrangements to procure the requisite weapons via other avenues. In re which, should your own connections suggest any such useful avenues, I should be grateful to hear of them. I write quickly, as Mr. Higgins has other errands, but my daughter bids me send herewith a box of matchsticks, her own invention. She has schooled Mr. Higgins most carefully in their use, so if he does not burst inadvertently into flame on the way back,
he will be able to demonstrate them to you. Your humble and obedient servant, James Fraser. Postscriptum. I require 30 muskets with as much powder and ammunition as may be possible. These need not be of the latest manufacture, but must be well kept and functional.
Other avenues, I said, watching him sand the letter before folding it. You mean smugglers? And if so, are you sure that Lord John will understand what you mean?
I do, and he will, Jamie assured me. Again, a few smugglers myself who bring things in through the outer banks. He'll know the ones who come through Roanoke, though. And there's more business there because of the blockade in Massachusetts. Goods come in through Virginia and go north overland.
He took a half-burned beeswax taper from the shelf and held it to the coals in the hearth, then dripped soft brown wax in a puddle over the seam of the letter. I leaned forward and pressed the back of my left hand into the warm wax, leaving the mark of my wedding ring in it.
"Damn Manfred MacGillivray," he said, with no particular heat. "It will be 3 times the cost, and I must get them from a smuggler."
"Will you ask about him, though? At the barbecue, I mean?" Flora MacDonald, the woman who had saved Charles Stuart from the English after Culloden, dressing him in her maid's clothes and smuggling him to a rendezvous with the French on the Isle of Skye, was a living legend to the Scottish Highlanders, and her recent arrival in the colony was the subject of vast excitement, news of it coming even as far as the Ridge. Every well-known Scot in the Cape Fear Valley, and a good many from farther away, would be present at the barbecue to be held in her honour. No better place to spread the word for a missing young man. He glanced up at me, surprised.
"Of course I will, Sassenach. What do you think I am?"
"I think you're very kind," I said, kissing him on the forehead, "if a trifle reckless. And I notice you carefully didn't tell Lord John why you need 30 muskets." He gave a small snort and swept the grains of sand carefully off the table into the palm of his hand.
"I dinna ken for sure myself, Sassenach."
"Whatever do you mean by that?" I asked, surprised. "Do you not mean to give them to Bird, after all?" He didn't answer at once, but the two stiff fingers of his right hand tapped gently on the tabletop. Then he shrugged, reached to the stack of journals and ledgers, and pulled out a paper which he handed to me. A letter from John Ashe, who had been a fellow commander of militia during the War of the Regulation. "The fourth paragraph," he said, seeing me frown at a recounting of the latest contretemps between the governor and the assembly. I obligingly skimmed down the page to the indicated spot, and felt a small, premonitory shiver. "A continental congress is proposed," I read, "with delegates to be sent from each colony. The lower house of the Connecticut Assembly has moved already to propose such men, acting through committees of correspondence. Some gentlemen with whom you are well acquainted propose that North Carolina shall do likewise, and will meet to accomplish the matter in mid-August. I could wish that you would join us, friend, for I am convinced that your heart and mind must lie with us in the matter of liberty. Surely such a man as yourself is no friend to tyranny." "Some gentlemen with whom you are well acquainted," I repeated, putting down the letter. "Do you know who he means?"
"I could guess."
"Mid-August, he says. Before the barbecue, do you think? Or after?"
"After. One of the others sent me the date of the meeting. It's to be in Halifax."
I put down the letter. The afternoon was still hot, and the thin linen of my shift was damp, as were the palms of my hands. "One of the others," I said. He shot me a quick glance with a half-smile and picked up the letter.
"In the Committee of Correspondence."
"Oh, naturally," I said. "You might have told me." Naturally, he would have found a means of inveigling himself into the North Carolina Committee of Correspondence, the centre of political intrigue, where the seeds of rebellion were being sown. Meanwhile, holding a commission as Indian agent for the British Crown, and ostensibly working to arm the Indians in order to suppress precisely those seeds of rebellion.
"I am telling you, Sassenach," he said. "This is the first time they've asked me to meet with them, even in private." I see, I said softly.
Will you go? Is it time?
Time to make the leap, declare himself openly as a Whig, if not yet a rebel. Time to change his public allegiance and risk the brand of treason. Again. He sighed deeply and rubbed a hand through his hair. He'd been thinking. The short hairs of several tiny cowlicks were standing on end.
I don't know, he said finally. It's 2 years yet, no? The 4th of July, 1776. That's what Brianna said.
No, I said. It's 2 years until they declare independence.
But, Jamie, the fighting will have started already. That will be much too late.
He stared at the letters on the desk and nodded bleakly.
Aye, it will have to be soon, then.
It would be likely safe enough, I said hesitantly. What you told me about Henderson buying land in Tennessee. If no one's stopping him, I can't see anyone in the government being agitated enough to come up here and try to force us out. And surely, not if you were only known to have met with the local Whigs.
He gave me a small, wry smile.
It's no the government I'm worried by, Sassenach. It's the folk nearby. It wasn't the governor who hanged the O'Briens and burnt their house, Ken. Nor was it Richard Brown, nor Indians. That wasn't done for the sake of law nor profit. It was done for hate, and very likely by someone who knew them.
That made a more pronounced chill skitter down my spine. There was a certain amount of political disagreement and discussion on the ridge, all right, but it hadn't reached the stage of fisticuffs yet, let alone burning and killing. But it would. I remembered, all too well, bomb shelters and ration coupons, blackout wardens and the spirit of cooperation against a dreadful foe. And the stories from Germany, France. People reported on, denounced to the SS, dragged from their houses. Others hidden in attics and barns, smuggled across borders. In war, government and their armies were a threat. But it was so often the neighbours who damned or saved you.
Who? I said boldly.
I could guess, he said, with a shrug. The McGillivrays, Richard Brown, Hodgepyle's friends, if he had any.
The friends of any of the other men we killed. The Indian you met, Donner, if he's still alive.
Neil Forbes. He's a grudge against Brianna. And she and Roger Mack would do well to remember it. Hiram Crombie and his lot.
Hiram? I said dubiously. Granted, he doesn't like you very much.
And as for me...
But...
Well, I do doubt it, he admitted. But it's possible, aye. His people didn't support the Jacobites at all. They'll no be pleased at an effort to overthrow the king from this side of the water, either.
I nodded. Crombie and the rest would of necessity have taken an oath of loyalty to King George before being allowed to travel to America. Jamie had, of necessity, taken the same oath as part of his pardon, and must, of an even greater necessity, break it. But when? He'd stopped drumming his fingers. They rested on the letter before him.
I do trust you're right, Sassenach, he said.
About what? What will happen?
You know I am, I said, a little surprised. Bree and Roger told you too. Why?
He rubbed a hand slowly through his hair.
I've never fought for the sake of principle, he said, reflecting, and shook his head. Only necessity. I wonder, would it be any better?
He didn't sound upset, merely curious, in a detached sort of way. Still, I found this vaguely disturbing.
But there is principle to it this time, I protested.
In fact, it may be the first war ever fought over principle.
Rather than something sordid, like trade or land, Jamie suggested, raising one eyebrow.
I don't say trade and land haven't anything to do with it, I replied,
wondering precisely how I'd managed to become a defender of the American Revolution,
an historical period I knew only from Brianna's school textbooks. But it goes well beyond that, don't you think? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Who said that? He asked, interested.
Thomas Jefferson will say it, on behalf of the New Republic. The Declaration of Independence, it's called, will be called.
All men, he repeated. Does he mean Indians as well, do you think?
I can't say, I said, rather irritated at being forced into this position. I haven't met him. If I do, I'll ask, shall I?
Never mind.
He lifted his fingers in brief dismissal.
I'll ask him myself, and I have the opportunity. Meanwhile, I'll ask Brianna.
He glanced at me.
Who was to principle, Sassenach?
He leaned back in his chair, folded his arms over his chest, and closed his eyes.
As long as but 100 of us remain alive, he said precisely, never will we on any conditions be brought under English rule. It is in truth not for glory, nor riches, nor honours that we are fighting, but for freedom, for that alone which no honest man gives up but with life itself.
The declaration of our birth, he said, opening his eyes. It gave me a lopsided smile.
Written some 400 years ago. Speaking of principles, eh?
He stood up then, but still remained standing by the battered table he used as a desk, looking down at Ash's letter.
As for my own principles, he said, as though to himself, but then looked at me as though suddenly realizing that I was still there.
Aye, I think I mean to give Bird the muskets, he said, though I may have cause to regret it, and I find them pointing at me 2 or 3 years hence. But he shall have them, and do with them what seems best to defend himself and his people.
The price of honour, is it?
He looked down at me with the ghost of a smile.
Call it blood money.
Chapter 54. Flora MacDonald's Barbecue. River Run Plantation, August the 6th, 1774.
Whatever did one say to an icon?
Or an icon's husband, for that matter.
Oh, I shall faint. I know I shall.
Rachel Campbell was fluttering her fan hard enough to create a perceptible breeze.
Whatever shall I say to her?
Good day, Mrs. MacDonald, suggested her husband,
a faint smile lurking at the corner of his withered mouth. Rachel hit him sharply with her fan, making him chuckle as he dodged away. For all he was 35 years her senior, Farquhar Campbell had an easy, teasing way with his wife, quite at odds with his usual dignified demeanour.
"I shall faint," Rachel declared again, having evidently decided upon this as a definite social strategy.
"Well, you must please yourself, of course, Anian. But if you do it, it will have to be Mr. Fraser picking you up from the ground. My ancient limbs are scarcely equal to the task."
"Oh!"
Rachel cast a quick glance at Jamie, who smiled at her, then hid her blushes behind her fan. While plainly fond of her own husband, she made no secret of her admiration for mine.
"Your humble servant, madam,"
Jamie gravely assured her, bowing.
She tittered. I shouldn't like to wrong the woman, but she definitely tittered.
I caught Jamie's eye and hid a smile behind my own fan.
"And what will you say to her then, Mr. Fraser?"
Jamie pursed his lips and squinted thoughtfully at the brilliant sun streaming through the elm trees that edged the lawn at River Run.
"Oh, I suppose I might say that I'm glad the weather has kept fine for her. It was raining the last time we met."
Rachel's jaw dropped, and so did her fan, bouncing on the lawn. Her husband bent to pick it up for her, groaning audibly, but she had no attention to spare for him.
"You've met her?" she cried, eyes wide with excitement. "When? Where? With the prin—" "With him?"
"Ah, no," Jamie said, smiling. "On Skye. I'd gone with my father, a matter of sheep it was. We chanced to meet Hugh MacDonald of Armadale in Portree, Miss Flora's stepfather, aye, and he'd brought the lass into the town with him for a treat.
Oh! Rachel was enchanted. And was she beautiful and gracious, as they say?
Jamie frowned, considering. Well, no, he said. But she'd a terrible grip at the time, and no doubt would have looked much improved without the red nose.
Gracious?
Well, I wouldn't say so, really. She snatched a bridie right out of my hand and ate it.
And how old were you both at the time? I asked, seeing Rachel's mouth sag in horror.
Oh, 6, maybe, he said cheerfully. Or 7. I doubt I should remember, save I kicked her in the shin when she stole my bridie, and she pulled my hair.
Recovering somewhat from the shock, Rachel was pressing Jamie for further reminiscences, a pressure he was laughingly deflecting with jokes.
Of course he'd come prepared to this occasion. All over the grounds there were stories being exchanged, humorous, admiring, longing, of the days before Culloden. Odd that it should have been the defeat of Charles Stuart and his ignominious flight that made a heroine of Flora MacDonald and united these Highland exiles in a way that they could never have achieved, let alone sustained, had he actually won. It struck me suddenly that Charlie was likely still alive, quietly drinking himself to death in Rome. In any real way, though, he was long since dead to these people who had loved or hated him. The amber of time had sealed him forever in that one defining moment of his life. Bliana Charlich. Charlie's year, it meant. And even now, I heard people call it that. It was Flora's coming that was causing this flood of sentiment, of course. How strange for her, I thought, with a pang of sympathy. And for the first time, wondered what on earth I might say to her myself. I had met famous people before, not the least of them, the Bonnie Prince himself. But always before, I had met them when they and I were in the midst of their normal lives, not yet past the defining events that would make them famous, and thus still just people. Bar Louis, but then he was a king. There are rules of etiquette for dealing with kings, since, after all, no one ever does approach them as normal people. Not even when... I snapped my own fan open, hot blood bursting through my face and body. I breathed deeply, trying not to fan quite as frantically as Rachel, but wanting to. I hadn't once, in all the years since it happened, ever specifically recalled those 2 or 3 minutes of physical intimacy with Louis of France. Not deliberately, God knew, and not by accident either. Yet suddenly the memory of it had touched me, as suddenly as a hand coming out of the crowd to seize my arm. Seize my arm, lift my skirts, and penetrate me in a way much more shockingly intrusive than the actual experience had been. The air around me was suffused with the scent of roses, and I heard the creak of the dress cage as Louis's weight pressed upon it, and heard his sigh of pleasure. The room was dark, lit by one candle. It flickered at the edge of vision, then was blotted out by the man between my... Christ, Claire! Are you all right? I hadn't actually fallen down, thank God. I had reeled back against the wall of Hector Cameron's mausoleum, and Jamie, seeing me go, had leapt forward to catch hold of me. Let go, I said, breathless but imperative. Let go of me! He heard the note of terror in my voice and slackened his grip, but couldn't bring himself to let go altogether lest I fall. With the energy of sheer panic, I pulled myself upright out of his grasp. I still smelled roses. Not the cloying scent of rose oil, fresh roses. Then I came to myself and realized that I was standing next to a huge yellow briar rose trained to climb over the white marble of the mausoleum. Knowing that the roses were real was comforting, but I felt as though I stood still on the edge of a vast abyss, alone, separate from every other soul in the universe. Jamie was close enough to touch, and yet it was as though he stood an immeasurable distance away.
Then he touched me and spoke my name insistently. And just as suddenly as it had opened, the gap between us closed. I nearly fell into his arms.
"What is it, Anian?"
he whispered, holding me against his chest.
"What's frightened you?"
His own heart was thumping under my ear. I'd scared him, too. "Nothing," I said, and an overwhelming wave of relief went over me at the realization that I was safely in the present. Louis had gone back into the shadows, an unpleasant but harmless memory once more. The staggering sense of violation, of loss and grief and isolation had receded, no more than a shadow on my mind. Best of all, Jamie was there, solid and physical and smelling of sweat and whiskey and horses. And there! I hadn't lost him. Other people were clustering round, curious, solicitous. Rachel fanned me earnestly, and the breeze of it felt soothing. I was drenched with sweat, wisps of hair clinging damply to my neck. "Quite all right," I murmured, suddenly self-conscious. "Just a bit faint. Hot day." A chorus of offers to fetch me wine, a glass of syllabub, lemon shrub, a burned feather, were all trumped by Jamie's production of a flask of whiskey from his sporran. It was the 3-year-old stuff from the sherry casks, and I felt a qualm as the scent of it reached me, remembering the night we had got drunk together after he had rescued me from Hodgepile and his men. God, was I about to be hurled back into that pit? But I wasn't. The whiskey was merely hot and consoling, and I felt better with the first sip. Flashback. I'd heard colleagues talk about it, arguing as to whether this was the same phenomenon as shell shock, and if it was, whether it truly existed, or should be dismissed as simply nerves. I shuddered briefly and took another sip. It most assuredly existed. I felt much better, but I'd been shaken to the core, and my bones still felt watery. Beyond the faint echoes of the experience itself was a much more unsettling thought. It had happened once before, when Uta MacGillivray attacked me. Was it likely to happen again?
"Shall I carry you inside, Sassenach? Perhaps you should lie down a bit."
Jamie had shooed away the well-wishers, had a slave fetch me a stool, and was now hovering over me like an anxious bumblebee. "No, I'm all right now," I assured him. "Jamie?"
"Aye, lass."
"You... when you... do you..." I took a deep breath and another sip of whiskey, and tried again. "Sometimes I wake up during the night and see you struggling, and I think it's with Jack Randall. Is it a dream that you have?" He stared down at me for a moment, face blank, but trouble moving in his eyes. He glanced from side to side, but we were quite alone now.
"Why?"
he asked, low-voiced. "I need to know." He took a breath, swallowed, and nodded.
"Aye. Sometimes it's dreams. That's all right. I wake and ken where I am, say a wee prayer, and... that's all right. But now and then..."
He shut his eyes for a moment, then opened them.
"I am awake. And yet I'm there with Jack Randall."
"Ah," I sighed, feeling at once terribly sad for him, and at the same time somewhat reassured. "Then I'm not losing my mind."
"You think so?"
he said dryly.
"Well, I'm glad to hear it, Sassenach."
He stood very close, the cloth of his kilt brushing my arm, so that I should have him for support if I suddenly went faint again. He looked searchingly at me to be sure that I wasn't going to keel over, then touched my shoulder, and with a brief,
"Sit still,"
went off. Not far, just to the tables set up under the trees at the edge of the lawn. Ignoring the slaves arranging food for the barbecue, he leaned across a platter of boiled crayfish and picked up something from a tiny bowl. Then he was back, leaning down to take my hand. He rubbed my fingers together, and a pinch of salt sprinkled into my open palm.
"There," he whispered. "Keep it by you, Sassenach. Whoever it is, he'll trouble you no more." I closed my hand over the damp grains, feeling absurdly comforted. Trust a Highlander to know precisely what to do about a case of daylight haunting. Salt, they said, kept a ghost in its grave. And if Louis was still alive, the other man, whoever he had been, that pressing weight in the dark, was surely dead. There was a sudden rush of excitement as a call came from the river. The boat had been sighted. As one, the crowd drew itself up on tiptoe, breathless with anticipation. I smiled, but felt the giddy contagion of it touch me nonetheless. Then the pipes began to skirl, and my throat at once was tight with unshed tears. Jamie's hand tightened on my shoulder unconsciously, and I looked up to see him rub his knuckles hard across his upper lip, as he, too, turned toward the river. I looked down, blinking to control myself, and as my vision cleared, I saw the grains of salt on the ground, carefully scattered before the gates of the mausoleum. She was much smaller than I'd thought. Famous people always are. Everyone, dressed in their best and an absolute sea of tartan, pressed close, awed past courtesy. I caught a glimpse of the top of her head, dark hair dressed high with white roses, and then it disappeared behind the thronged backs of well-wishers. Her husband, Alan, was visible, a stoutly handsome man with grey-streaked black hair tied neatly back. He was standing, I assumed, behind her, bowing and smiling, acknowledging the flood of Gaelic compliment and welcome. Despite myself, I felt the urge to rush forward and stare with everyone else. I held firm, though. I was standing with Jocasta on the terrace. Mrs. MacDonald would come to us. Sure enough, Jamie and Duncan were pushing their way firmly through the crowd, forming a flying wedge with Jocasta's black butler, Ulysses. "That's really her?" Brianna murmured at my shoulder, eyes fixed with interest on the seething multitude, from which the men had now extracted the guest of honour, escorting her from the dock, up the lawn, toward the terrace. "She's smaller than I thought. Oh, it's too bad Roger isn't here. He'd just die to see her." Roger was spending a month at the Presbyterian Academy at Charlotte, having his qualifications for ordination examined. "He may get to see her another time," I murmured back. "I hear they've bought a plantation near Barbecue Creek by Mount Pleasant." And they would stay in the colony for at least another year or two. But I didn't say that out loud. So far as the people here knew, the MacDonalds had immigrated permanently. But I had seen the tall memorial stone on Skye, where Flora MacDonald had been born and would someday die, disillusioned with America. It wasn't the first time I'd met someone and known of their fate, of course, but it was always unsettling. The crowd opened, and she stepped out, small and pretty, laughing up at Jamie. He had a hand under her elbow, guiding her up onto the terrace, and made a gesture of introduction toward me. She looked up, expectant, met my gaze dead on, and blinked, her smile momentarily fading. It was back in an instant, and she was bowing to me, and I to her. But I did wonder what she had seen in my face. But she turned at once to greet Jocasta and introduce her grown daughters, Anne and Fanny, a son-in-law, her husband. By the time she had accomplished the confusion of introductions, she was perfectly in command of herself, and greeted me with a charming, gentle smile. "Mrs. Fraser, I am so much obliged to meet you at last. I have heard such stories of your kindness and skill. I confess I am in awe to be in your presence." It was said with so much warmth and sincerity, she seizing me by the hands, that I found myself responding, in spite of a cynical wonder as to who she'd been talking to about me. My reputation in Cross Creek and Campbellton was notorious, but not universally lauded by any means.
I had the honour of Dr. Fentiman's acquaintance at the subscription ball held for us in Wilmington. So kind, so amazingly kind of everyone. We have been so well treated since our arrival, and he was quite in raptures regarding your... I should have liked to hear what had enraptured Fentiman. Our relations were still marked by a certain wariness, although we had reached a rapprochement. But at this point, her husband spoke in her ear, desiring her to come and meet Farquhar Campbell and some other prominent gentlemen. And with a regretful grimace, she squeezed my hands and departed, the brilliant public smile back in place. Rhee remarked, sotto voce. Lucky for her, she's still got most of her teeth. That was, in fact, exactly what I'd been thinking. And I laughed, converting it into a hasty coughing fit as I saw Jocasta's head turn sharply towards us. So that's her. Young Ian had come up on my other side and was watching the guest of honour with an expression of deep interest. He was dressed in kilt, waistcoat and coat for the occasion, his brown hair done up in a proper queue, and he looked quite civilised, bar the tattoos that looped across his cheekbones and over the bridge of his nose.
That's her, Jamie agreed. Fionnuachall, the fair one.
There was a surprising note of nostalgia in his voice, and I glanced at him in surprise.
Well, it's a proper name, he said mildly. Fionnuachall. It's only the English call her Flora.
Did you have a crush on her when you were little, da? Brianna asked, laughing.
A what?
A tendresse, I said, batting my eyelashes delicately at him over my fan.
Och, dinna be daft, he said. I was 7 years old, for God's sake.
Nonetheless, the tips of his ears had gone quite pink.
I was in love when I was 7, Ian remarked rather dreamily, with a cook. Did you hear Ulysses say as she's brought a looking-glass, uncle, given to her by Prince Charlech, with his arms upon the bag? Ulysses put it in the parlour with two of the grooms to stand guard over it.
Sure enough, those people who weren't in the swirling crowd surrounding the McDonald's were all pressing through the double doors into the house, forming a line of animated chatter down the hall to the parlour. Seamus! Jocasta's imperious voice put a stop to the teasing. Jamie gave Brianna an austere look and went to join her. Duncan was detained in conversation with a small knot of prominent men. I recognised Neil Forbes the lawyer, as well as Cornelius Harnett and Colonel Moore. And Ulysses was nowhere in sight, most likely dealing with the backstage logistics of a barbecue for 200 people, thus leaving Jocasta temporarily marooned. Her hand on Jamie's arm, she sailed off the terrace, heading for Alan MacDonald, who had become detached from his wife by the press of people round her, and was standing under a tree, looking vaguely affronted. I watched them go across the lawn, amused by Jocasta's sense of theatrics. Her body servant, Phedre, was dutifully following and could plainly have guided her mistress. That wouldn't have had at all the same effect, though. The two of them together made heads turn, Jocasta tall and slender, graceful despite her age, and striking with her white hair piled high and her blue silk gown. Jamie, with his Viking height and crimson Fraser tartan, both with those bold Mackenzie bones and cat-like grace. "Colum and Dougal would be proud of their little sister," I said, shaking my head.
"Oh, aye."
Ian spoke absently, not attending. He was still watching Flora MacDonald, now accepting a bunch of flowers from one of Farquhar Campbell's grandchildren, to general applause. "Not jealous, are you, Mama?" Brianna teased, seeing me glance in the same direction. "Certainly not," I said, with a certain amount of complacence. "After all, I have all my teeth, too." I had missed him in the initial crush, but Major MacDonald was among the revellers, looking very flash in a brilliantly scarlet uniform coat and a new hat, lavish with gold lace. He removed this object and bowed low to me, looking cheerful. No doubt because I was unaccompanied by livestock,
Adso and the white sow being both safely on Fraser's Ridge.
"Your servant, mum," he said. "I saw that you had a word with Miss Flora. So charming is she not. And a canty, handsome woman as well."
"Indeed she is," I agreed. "Do you know her, then?"
"Oh, aye," he said,
a look of profound satisfaction spreading across his weathered face.
"I should not dare to the presumption of friendship, but believe I may stake a modest claim to acquaintancy. I accompanied Mrs. MacDonald and her family from Wilmington, and have had the great honour to assist in settling them in their present situation."
"Did you really?" I gave him an interested eye. The Major wasn't the type to be awed by celebrity. He was the type to appreciate its uses.
So was Governor Martin, evidently.
The Major was watching Flora MacDonald now, with a proprietary eye, noting with approval the way in which people clustered round her.